Everyone gets hit hardest with nerves in one spot. Maybe your stomach, your chest, your throat, your legs. For me, it's my neck. When I'm freaking out, I feel like my neck is bulging. I visualize the ball of energy in my neck and stay there for a second, just experiencing it and allowing it to pulse and constrict. Then I send it down and all around my body. I imagine that anxious feeling going from my neck down into my chest, through my arms and legs, all the way to my fingers and toes. I try to get my toes in on the nervous game. You still have the same nerves after this practice, but you dilute their power by spreading them all over. This approach takes practice. I mean, it doesn't always work for me now. But whether you can make those butterflies move or not, this exercise gives your brain something to focus on besides being nervous. You are literally focusing on something else for that moment. Whereas before, you were only focused on having the panic attack. And also, if you screw up, nobody really cares anyway. We'll talk about that later, but the truth is, we feel like everyone is watching and judging us. No, people just really care about themselves. You've likely seen someone really botch a presentation or be really nervous speaking in public and then never given it a second thought once it was done. Return the favor to yourself. If you know anything about me, you know that being on time and being prepared are two things that I excel at. Talent's not a big ingredient in my success. It's showing up over and over again, even when nobody wants me there, and being better prepared each time. That night, as I waited to take the stage in Roanoke for the second performance of what now felt like a very long comedy tour, I knew I might bomb again, but I was as prepared as I could be in that moment. I had stayed up all night rewriting my material based on feedback from my first show. I had covered every part of the theater physically and mentally, and before the show, I did my visualization exercise so that my jitters didn't kill whatever kernel of humor I had left in me, and then I got dressed. Now, I'm very into patterns. I love routines. I think they build brain muscle memory and foster a feeling of familiarity, which provides comfort for most of us. I have different rituals for different occasions, but when it comes to my stand-up shows, I get dressed the same exact way every time. As a matter of fact, I wear the exact same uniform for every show. For my tour last year, I always wore a short-sleeved button-up shirt with a tie, black pants, red socks, red shoes. Recently, I embarked on matching all my red socks, which was probably about 200 pairs. I dumped them all on the couch. After about 2 hours, I made about 30 matches, and I gave up. That was dumb. I actually named my tour this year the Red Hoodie Comedy Tour because I wanted to wear a red hoodie to every show. If my routine or options are limited, so is the chance for me to mess it up. And it's one less thing that I have to worry about when I pack to travel to shows. When I finally do put on my artist armor, it feels like it's time to go to work. Getting dressed is a routine I put in place to make me feel a certain way. Here's how I do it each time. Socks always first, the black pants, then shoes, then shirt, then the hair, then the tie, and finally the glasses. Now, you hear me say this, that may seem absolutely insane to you, but my routines and superstitions keep me from thinking about anything else but comedy. When it comes to my clothes, I already know. And like Biggie said, if you don't know, now you know. Saying my routine back, I am aware of how insane I sound. Insane, but efficient. After straightening my glasses, I took the stage in Roanoke, and I killed. No, just kidding. I didn't kill, but I did get a little better. Baby steps, right? I can remember every moment of that show in Roanoke as if I'm on stage right now. I was so drilled down into my set that I felt each laugh and silence in the room as if they were happening in my own body. I registered my hits and my misses, but when my timing was off or a joke didn't make sense, I didn't freeze or freak out. When the audience didn't like some of my material, listen, it was clear sometimes that they didn't. It wasn't something happening to me. I didn't feel like a passive victim. Instead, I was still at the mic. I thought, oh, that didn't work, but next time this will. It was amazing what trying to improve did for my comfort level, and I couldn't have done that if the audience didn't allow me to see clearly exactly where I sucked. And here we are, the main point of this whole chapter, why you need to have someone in your life who will let you know that you suck. The crowd at the comedy show laughs hard at the start of every set. They want to like what they paid money to see. The first time they don't laugh, you know they're now dialed in and expecting true entertainment. When a crowd doesn't laugh, it's on. Instead of getting angry or annoyed that they're not giving me the freebies anymore, I think, okay, it's about to get awesome. When I tell a joke and they don't laugh, that's what excites me because I know now I have to earn every single laugh. And so every laugh that comes after the first miss is an honest-to-goodness piece of greatness. I earned it. The question here is whether you accept being told you suck or will you just stand up there with the attitude, oh, they just don't get me. The same is true with friends. While it's important to have champions, those folks who tell you you're great, it's equally important, but a lot harder to find an honest critic who also wants you to succeed. Lots of people will fluff you up, particularly if you start to do well. You need someone you trust in your life who will always give you their real opinion. If a person can tell you, that wasn't good, then you'll really believe it when he or she says, hey, that was great. If you find a friend or colleague like this, one whose compliments mean more because their criticism is real, hold on tight to them because they are rare and they are valuable. It's hard to be told things we don't want to hear. Who wants to know that what we're doing isn't perfect or even any good? But if we, you, I, really want to improve, you have to be willing to be coached by hearing what's not working. Again, it's not easy or comfortable. For real, it feels like crap. But if you can intellectualize the idea that criticism is awesome because it will lead to actually being awesome, you can move past hurt feelings and into true hope. The compliments are that much more awesome when they do come because you know they're real. Let me put it another way. People's praise makes you know better at whatever it is you want to do. So, do you want to get better? If so, then nut up and understand that being told you suck is great. I get a lot of you suck from the internet. People calling my radio show, the audience at my live comedy shows. And I do appreciate the honesty of it. It makes the laughs that much sweeter. The audience in Virginia Beach made me better for Roanoke, which made me better going into the next weekend of this massive undertaking. Standing under the lights of venues that my comedic heroes like George Carlin, Ricky Gervais, Chris Rock had played, I wouldn't have been able to speak a syllable if I didn't accept that it was okay for me to not be amazing as long as I was moving forward. In fact, I took a lot of pressure off myself by believing I didn't have to get funnier to feel like I was getting better. I have to admit, though, that no matter how much I pride myself in taking constructive criticism, sometimes even I'm slow on the take. Case in point, my Beauty and the Beast bestiality joke. Now, again, it's hard for me to tell a joke here as I'm reading this to you. There are no laughs, but there were no laughs when I told it either. Here's the joke. So why is everybody going so crazy about this new live-action Beauty and the Beast movie? Frankly, I'm weirded out by the whole thing. I mean, the premise is great. Hot girl gives ugly guy a shot. He proves his heart is amazing, and then they're together forever. But I saw the trailer, and I can't get past the fact that it looks like Harry Potter having intercourse with a large, angry donkey. And if I wanted to see a female and an animal get it on, I would look at this guy's phone. And then I point in the crowd. On tour, I tried that joke 20 ways. Nothing. Crickets. As I'm telling you this now, I can't figure out why people didn't find it funny. Maybe the structure was no good. Maybe there isn't a large market for animal and human sex jokes. It's funny to me. Whatever the reason, I scrapped it, but not before running it into the ground. That time, the feedback just took a long time to sink in. Going back to my John Mayer talk mentioned earlier in the book, he said something that resonated with me. The things that we think are the absolute most creative, amazing parts of our minds really don't resonate with the masses as much as we'd like them to. He said, it's mostly the stuff right in the middle that we're like, this is just pretty good, that hits people right in the best way. He was probably talking about some super genius guitar playing or musical masterpiece that he had written that didn't quite make it to the top of the charts. For me, it was a joke about humping a donkey. Anyway, back to my original point. The moral of my failure at bestiality humor is that when a joke doesn't land, you don't quit comedy. You work on the joke, or you move to a different joke. You don't throw the baby out the window if you don't like the temperature of the bathwater, or whatever that saying is. I have no problem admitting that I've said 1,000 dumb things on the radio and written many bad jokes. And I'm glad I look back on those moments and cringe. And I'm not including my Beauty and the Beast joke in that. That was funny, no matter what anybody thinks. But if I'm not ashamed of whatever product I put out 18 months ago, at least a little bit, then I've stopped growing or stopped caring about growing. I'm into thinking that my old work was bad. I'm good with that. I used to hate my self-hatred. That's why I would never listen to or look at anything that I had done in the past. If I heard a few minutes from one of my old radio shows, I was filled with embarrassment for me that I put out such a dumb show, for my bosses who were dumb enough to pay me to do it, and for the poor people who had to listen to it while they drove to work. But now I take a much more positive view of that negative feeling so many of us get when we look back on past performance, professional or personal. My new mantra is constant dissatisfaction is the way that I stay satisfied. Just like I turn my nerves from a debilitating condition into my rocket fuel, so I take my angst with myself and turn it into a marker of how far I've come. I now listen back on shows from 2 years ago and think, man, I wasn't very good then. But if I didn't feel that way, if I thought those shows were awesome, that would be a terrible sign. It would mean I was the same. In my world, if you aren't moving forward, you're moving backward. It doesn't matter if you're telling jokes or working on a spreadsheet. Never be satisfied with where you are. Always find a new way to engage in the fight. Enjoy being embarrassed tomorrow by what you're doing today. I guess what I'm saying is, who better to tell you that you suck than you? So here is a quiz. Do you need to find someone to tell you that you suck? I'll ask you a few questions. When your food arrives cold in a restaurant, you A, eat it, B, eat it but complain the entire time, C, respectfully ask the waiter to heat it up, or D, throw your plate against the wall. Think of your letter answer there. Question number two. If your boss asks you to redo a work project, do you A, cry, B, quit, C, ask a lot of questions and do your best to meet his or her expectations, or D, play Plants vs. Zombies for 20 minutes on your phone, wait to be asked by your boss again, and then scramble to redo it? Question three. You look in the mirror A, rarely, B, often, C, whenever necessary, or D, just to watch yourself dance so you can see your sweet dance moves. Now, that's only three of the 10 questions. Buy the real book. You can circle them and then find out how much of a nutcase that you really are, because there is an answer key there. If you answer mostly A's, you're a type of person. If you answer mostly B's, you're a certain type of person. But quite frankly, I don't want to read all the questions here on the audiobook because you can't keep up with it anyway. You're either running or in your car or listening to this on the subway. So let's move on. Chapter 4, Not Everyone Is Going to Like You. Last night was crazy, so crazy that I had to include it in this book. And I know I've been writing about a lot of things happening to me during my comedy shows, but I mostly write this on weekends, so suck it up and listen to another story, please. Thank you. It started out as a normal weekend day, which for me means out on the road. I had just finished a really fun show at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. On the drive to the next tour stop in Northampton, Massachusetts, I was in an especially good mood and ready to celebrate, which for me means food. After doing my sound check and meeting about 100 fans, I left the theater in Northampton and walked over to a place called Local Burger so I could eat. Now, normally, I'd go with a turkey burger or salad since I try to eat light and tight, but there was something on the menu that I just couldn't ignore. Captain Crunch chicken tenders, fried chicken, and Captain Crunch cereal. What's next, Fruit Loop hot dogs? Because I would try that too. Now, I crushed these pieces of amazing cereal-covered chicken. They brought me a lot of joy for a couple of reasons. First of all, as a kid, I could have never afforded Captain Crunch. We settled for Sergeant Crunchy. It was in the bag on the bottom shelf of the cereal aisle. It was kind of like Captain Crunch, but it was cheaper without the toy in it. Much less those sweet, sweet tenders. And that thought, a reminder of how far I've come, always brings me a moment of happiness. But also normally, I eat like a monk abstaining from all pleasures of the flesh. I eat the same thing for lunch every day. It might not be delicious, but it maintains my girlish figure. I don't have built-in cheat days like most people who eat very healthy, mainly because I think the concept is weak. Change your lifestyle slowly. No one goes from 0 to 100 in a day, week, or even a month. You will have setbacks, and that's fine, but to call it cheating makes it seem like you're doing something wrong, and then to sanction doing something wrong? What if you continued that logic beyond food and into the rest of your life, and set aside 1 week as a cheat day at school, at work, in a relationship? That's just not my style. Now, I was a little heavier than usual, but a lot happier. I returned to the theater to get ready for my 8 p.m. show. Around 9 p.m., after my first two opening acts finished, I walked out on the stage to the White Stripes song, Seven Nation Army, and I could tell immediately it was a good crowd because they were clapping in unison to the walkout music. That doesn't happen every show. There were 1,400 people, most of whom were pretty drunk and were clearly ready to enjoy my shenanigans. A half hour into my set, I was in the middle of a joke about a car ride that I had taken that day when I noticed some scuffling in the lower right side of the theater. "I'm gonna shoot you!" someone yelled from the audience. I heard it as clear as day, and so did everyone else in the venue, which was now filled with screaming, so I stopped the show and I sat down on this stage. Of course, the rare time I needed to use my athletic prowess and dart-like speed was the first time that I'd eaten Cap'n Crunch chicken tenders, and I felt as heavy as a waterlogged brick. I didn't leave because I felt like I was down low enough on the stage that if an audience member was hoping to shoot me, I'd be a really tough target. Not to mention, really, the fact is that if I left, the promoter could say I didn't fulfill my contractual time and not pay me. I gotta eat, after all, and hopefully more meat dipped in Captain Crunch. Now, I couldn't really tell what was going on, except that eventually the cops arrived, and I assumed the troublemaker was escorted out because the screaming had stopped. I stood back up, and although I had lost most of the crowd, the show must go on. I told a few jokes, juggled a bit, played a few funny songs. I did the best I could to get back an audience that had just heard a man yell he was going to shoot someone. I'm not even sure Chappelle could do that. Actually, probably could. The dude's awesome. After the show, I was debriefed on what had actually happened. Turns out someone really didn't like my jokes. It started with a bit that rolled my issues with mustaches and recent experience with an Uber driver into a song I wrote called Mr. Uber Driver, which kind of goes like this. "Mr. Uber Driver, I'm standing on the curb. Your mustache makes you look like a perv. I don't want to judge you by the hair that's on your face. 911's on my phone just in case." A guy in the audience, perhaps a misunderstood Uber driver, heckled me because he didn't like the song. Then a lady who apparently enjoyed my comedy stylings told him to shut up, which made him angry, so he threatened to, quote, shoot the chick. Cops came. Bam. It was my first show with an intermission in the middle of a set. I've spent a lot of years wondering how to get the most people to like what I do. I mean, I'm in entertainment, and the entire mission is to be popular. And yet, despite all the work I put into being liked, there was a man out there in the audience, so offended by me that he was willing to threaten murder. Listen, the joke wasn't great. A solid B at best. It was a song, but I mean, shoot someone? Okay, I can imagine what you're thinking right now. That's your best example for why it's foolish to try to win over the world? Look, I don't have a normal life, so I have another one for you. And it involves the favorite medium of haters. Yeah, Facebook. Hurtful posts. Now, that's something every single person can relate to, right? I'd like to share just one of the many, many Facebook posts on how much I suck. This one came from another radio guy, one who I don't know if I've ever met. In the post, my radio colleague goes to great lengths to discuss how much I suck, how I funded a smear campaign against myself, how I fooled my staff with fake death threats and needs bodyguards, and how my successes caused thousands like him to lose their jobs. He called me a narcissistic, self-centered buffoon. I'm the first one to say how much I suck sometimes, but despite him bolding the word truth in his actual post, so that means what he's writing is real, this post irritated me because it was literally a bunch of lies. If you want to complain about me being a loser, have the courtesy to at least stick to the facts. There are plenty of them. If it wasn't readily apparent, let me break down the jerkiness of this Facebook post. Fake death threats. Here are the facts. I've never faked a death threat. On every occasion where something crazy has happened, like someone trying to stab me on my way into work, or the correspondence I've received more than once where the sender says they want to kill me, I've called the real cops because it was a real threat. The story about how I spent money to reverse engineer a billboard campaign against myself. Well, I guess that inside source he got that from was me, because I told that story in my last book before anyone else got their hands on it. And finally, narcissistic, self-centered buffoon. In fairness, he did get a few things right. I only went through this painful and not all that productive exercise of analyzing a hater's post because in this age of Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, and the rest, pretty much every single human being on earth has had someone he or she probably doesn't know come at them with baseless and just plain mean accusations. Unfortunately, in the internet age, it's just too easy to take people down. You're safe and hidden behind the computer screen, which means most of the online haters are nothing but cowards. It still hurts though when folks don't like you, and there's nothing you can do about that. Repeat this. Sometimes people aren't going to like you, and you can't do anything about it. Nobody is saying that accepting that fact is easy, because life is essentially just a search for love. It's probably the hardest thing I'll ask you to do in this book. Everyone wants to be liked, even a constantly irritated guy like myself. That instinct is so strong that whenever we are not liked, we have to find reasons the person who doesn't like us is wrong, or just simply stop caring. And the act of not caring, ironically, makes you more likable. Whether it's dating, your career, or making new friends, a lot of people find others more attractive when they're aloof. Unfortunately, caring can be misread as desperation or neediness. There's a weird phenomenon where once you say, ah, screw it, others find you more attractive. It's not unlike the cool kids in high school or college. The most popular kids were always the ones who acted like they didn't care or were rich. And I wasn't either one of them because I did care. My technique of flipping unlikability on its head started out as a defense mechanism. When I was young, popularity wasn't even on my radar. I would have settled for just finding a place or group where I fit. For me, though, fitting in has never been straightforward. It started early. I was so poor. I had to be Raggedy Andy for 3 years in a row on Halloween. That was my costume. My costume literally was to dress up as a poor kid. The theme continued through the early part of my career when, as an alternative and pop DJ, I was deemed too country. And yet when I moved over to country music, I didn't fit in because I was too pop. I think I wear people down more than I win them over. I compare myself to the show Ozark, where Jason Bateman plays a forlorn money launderer banished to a resort town in Missouri. At first, I thought the show was terrible. The pilot was so slow, but those rednecks on the show are basically me. So I stuck with it, and by the third episode, I was hooked. The show's fantastic. That's who I am, a slow burner, an acquired taste. My presence has never made sense anywhere I've been, or at least any place I've wanted to be. And since I've never been a member of the cool club from the start, of course I'd come up with a philosophy that centers around how not being popular is pretty cool in itself. So yeah, my belief that chasing acceptance is a waste of time is definitely a defense mechanism, but it's a good one because it's kept me honest. Anything I've ever embraced because everyone's doing it has never worked out for me to the point where it's better for me to trust my gut instincts going into any job, relationship, or outfit. In the short term, people might think I'm crazy, but my experience has proven it's worth the long-term investment. Never fitting in anywhere has forced me how to learn to survive and thrive everywhere because of the lessons that I can learn. Popular math. Now, this is a simple equation that I've seen written many times in many ways. Basically, you can have 50% of people hate you and 50% of people love you, or 100% that have no passion for you whatsoever. And as much as it sucks to have people not like you, you can't control that if you're trying to make an impact. I can't control how everyone's going to respond to me. Sometimes there might be a guy, like the one in Massachusetts, who didn't like one of my jokes and therefore wanted to shoot someone. But a lot of people that night did like my joke. And that's better than no one hearing or reacting to my joke at all. But the very best thing is that no one got shot, right? The answer to how to be the most likable person is to be so real with yourself that it just doesn't matter to you. Don't look for the negative needle. Hate can often feel louder than love. I'm not just doing my best impression of a yoga instructor or a preacher here. That sentence might sound like a cheesy platitude, but it's true. Love can be silent, but hate is noisy and obnoxious. Think about it this way. Rarely do people call or email an airline to pay a compliment for a wonderful flight. But you can guarantee that if something is amiss, from lost luggage to the flight attendant running out of sun chips, Southwest Airlines is going to get an email, a tweet, a Facebook message, and possibly a turd by FedEx. Because we don't outwardly react when things are positive, choosing instead to appreciate silently. And get so vocal when things are negative, it's easy to become overwhelmed by the sounds of fury. And because we live in a time where there are so many outlets for that anger, like I talked about earlier, Twitter, Facebook, etc., the noise is that much more amplified. When you're on the receiving end of the hate, it can feel awful, no matter how great your life is. Major musicians and other big-time artists suffer from this phenomenon all the time. The one who comes to mind, because the level of criticism he receives is in inverse proportion to his popularity, is Sam Hunt. Sam Hunt is currently the biggest thing in country music, which is a minor miracle considering how progressive he is at times in a format not known to be open to progressive sounds. The country format rightfully takes great pride in its roots, but at times, adherence to those roots can be counterproductive to making great music. Anything with a different sound is often fought tooth and nail by the purists of the format, and the term, "that's not country," is used too often as a definition, when really, it's just one person's opinion. The irony is that many of the extremely successful artists I've talked to about this idea were told they weren't country either. Garth Brooks is an example. He told me he was tagged with the "that's not country" label many times after he moved to Nashville. Now, we look at Garth as a staple of the format. Also, he's the highest selling American solo artist of all time, not just in country, but in all formats, bigger than Elvis. Look it up. These days, if you listen to any of the very vocal traditionalists, you'd think people actually hated Sam Hunt and his sound, which is rooted in country, but with significant R&B influence. He didn't win any of the major awards for his song, "Body Like a Backroad," which was arguably the biggest hit of the last 5 years. Just a note, because I wrote this book before the ACMs of 2018, he later did win one award for "Body Like a Backroad." But at the time I wrote this, he had won no awards. He sells out amphitheaters in minutes. It's nuts how unembraced he is by a small decision-making section in Nashville. Yet, Sam continues to create and is absolutely loved by the mostly silent majority. I guess not getting the big awards is okay when you sell out everything you touch and every song you put out turns to gold. In a recent talk that I had with Kip Moore, check out his episode of my podcast called The Bobby Cast. It's great. He actually gets up and pees right in the middle of it. Kip does not give a beep. By the way, Kip's another country artist and now a friend. And we spent at least half an hour discussing how hard it is to ignore those one or two people having a bad time at a show. There can be 10,000 people dancing and singing, but you see that negative needle, it throws you. I learned from Steve Martin, who said, "Look only at their foreheads." Performers can be at the top of their game and still a harsh review from a critic or a nasty meme about them making the internet rounds can ruin their day. Of course, they could probably console themselves with a forehand massage at the Ritz-Carlton or a shopping spree since they're mostly rich and all. But seriously though, insults affect everyone personally. The only reason celebrities don't acknowledge them more publicly is because there's a rule of stardom that you're never supposed to punch down. Even if the biggest internet troll is biting at your toes in the most terrible way, you don't react. Engaging in an insult match with anyone about why you don't suck is not a good look. As you can hear, if you've been listening since the beginning of this chapter, I do not follow this rule myself and have no problems punching down, no matter how stupid and petty it makes me appear. I'm willing to rip apart a Facebook post about how I'm a liar who employs a team of Wookiees in a book. Something that sticks around a lot longer than sounding off in your feed. But when has good taste ever stopped me before? Never. That's when. No matter how successful I become, there's part of me that will always be the kid who cares just a little too much. I know it's not winning me any points, so since this is a self-help book, let me give you a piece of advice. Don't follow my example on this one. My desire to shut down anyone who hates on me is not only ultimately bad for my image, it's also futile. The scenario of being punished for your success is no different than back in elementary school when bullies beat on the kids with good grades because they didn't feel good about themselves. I'm not excusing giving anyone a black eye as an ego-boosting mechanism. I'm just saying it's a thing. This is the law of nature, like gravity, or the gene in men that makes it impossible for us to put the toilet seat down. If you're doing well, you're going to get the bad from others who aren't doing so well. It doesn't matter if they don't have the talent or if they haven't put in the work. People are always upset at others getting stuff they don't. I get upset, but I try to use my jealousy as fuel for my fight and not take down others. Note the word try. I try. When others turn themselves into emotional stumbling blocks on the path toward your goal, the right thing to do is to wish them the best, keep your face forward, and continue to fight. Take the good with the bad. But we're humans, not saints. Turning the other cheek is great, but not if it gives you an ulcer and totally erodes your self-confidence. Knowing that having one's ability questioned bothers everyone, even the rich, famous, and talented. And that's a good first step in putting negativity in its place, to know that you're not alone. Nobody likes it. There's another important strategy that I use to stay strong in the face of any amount of criticism. Don't search for the negative needle in the haystack, because no matter how huge the stack, you'll find the needle. Here's what I mean by that. If 10 people give you a compliment and one says, "You suck." Well, "you suck" are the two words that you're going to remember the most. Break the habit. And you never truly will, but at least you can be conscious of your tendency to do this. In a recent episode of my podcast, I talked with Cole Swindell about this very issue. As I say this to you, he's had 7 number one songs as a performer and 10 as a writer. And he talked about only seeing the bad comments that poke out like a cold sore. Now, instead of my cold sore metaphor, which I recognize is pretty weird, I was going to say sticks out like a sore thumb, but I realized that's probably dated and I've never actually noticed someone's sore thumb. I always notice when someone has a cold sore though. Maybe I'll make that saying a thing. That's just a little insight into my process as I'm telling you all this. That's how my head works. Learning to accept that you did a great job or were a great friend or a great spouse instead of constantly searching for the thing you did wrong isn't just a feel-good policy. And it has nothing to do with taking constructive criticism. They're two separate planets revolving around the sun that is you. Negativity hunting does not lead to self-improvement or personal growth. I know what I'm talking about, mainly because I'm the worst when it comes to looking for the negative needle. I will pour through thousands of positive comments with all the concentration of a researcher combing through rare manuscripts in order to find the 2 comments that completely destroy me. The worst me. I spent a lot of wasted time torturing myself in this exercise, not even aware of what I was doing. It wasn't until I saw the trait in others, like Cole Swindell talking about it, that I recognized it in myself. If you have a few minutes, search for that podcast. It's called The Bobby Cast on iTunes, on iHeartRadio, and listen to that episode with Cole Swindell. He has it all. Young guy, success, talent, money. But still, those little jabs that don't matter were mattering to him. And that opened my eyes. "Why are you paying attention to this?" I asked. "It's a totally worthless throwaway opinion." No sooner had those words come out of my mouth than I realized, oh crap, I do this too. Once I was able to acknowledge in myself something I hadn't been smart enough to notice before, I began to see it everywhere. I watch people in a wide array of fields who are great at what they do be waterboarding level tortured by 1 or 2 offhand remarks. I know an amazing chef who had to get wasted drunk after reading a negative comment too offensive to even say here, that someone wrote in pen on a bathroom wall of his restaurant. It didn't matter that his food has been written up in magazines as some of the best in the South, or that you can't even get into his place on a Saturday night. Nope, some Sharpie scrawl in the bathroom sent him over the edge. Why would you let anyone, particularly someone with no knowledge of your story, take apart all that you've accomplished? Part of the fight is resisting that natural reflex to look for the negative needle. Things aren't often going to go right in your fight. So when they do, however you define that for yourself, just enjoy it. And when you catch yourself not enjoying it, be conscious of it. Maybe next time you will. Small steps. Oh, and don't be a hater. Just for good measure, don't be a hater either. We all do it, even if we don't mean to. Or if we mean to, but think we're justified because, of course, the thing or person or place we're hating on deserves it, still don't do it. Once you accept that we all have hater tendencies, you can get to the business of establishing some boundaries. You're getting absolutely nothing accomplished by aiming negative thoughts or words at someone else's action, and you're wasting your own time when you could be accomplishing something that someone else could be hating on. Why spend time and energy doing something counterproductive to what's good for you? There is no answer other than it makes us feel good in the short term. Long term, though, we usually feel worse than before we started because we're embarrassed by our own shortcomings, which is the reason for the hating in the first place. And then we're also embarrassed by how we handled it, which is the act of actually hating. So don't do it. We can make more money, friends, kids, but the only thing we can't create more of is time. We get what we get, and everything in life takes time. I bring up this precious commodity in terms of hoping you figure out what your fight is all about. Time is a major factor in the equation of negativity. You can spend your time making fun of a work colleague or putting down someone's looks because you're really jealous, or you can spend that time still feeling that way, but instead of acting on it, acknowledge it, and then question why you feel that way. Instead of going off on Facebook, take an honest glimpse inside and ask yourself, do I feel like this because I'm not doing as well as I want to? If the answer is yes, you know what you gotta do. Stop looking at others, put your head down, and get back to your fight. It's okay that not everyone likes you. And you don't have to like everyone either. But use your time and energy to build things instead of tearing them down. Nothing ever came from being critical of the accomplishments of others. Well, unless you have a job as a critic, and I'm not quite sure how those pay nowadays. My biggest failure, from Charlemagne the God. This is the guy I call whenever I need someone to lean on or make sure that I'm not crazy. He's always got my back. I always have his. Maybe that's because Charlemagne, the radio and TV personality, came up the hard way like I did, and he's never forgotten it. So Charlemagne said this, and I quote, this is from Charlemagne the God. My biggest failure was not listening to my father, mother, grandmother, and every other elder who was trying to tell me to change my lifestyle at an early age. I had a hard head. And as they say in the country, a hard head makes a soft beep. My father always told me if I kept running the streets the way I was, I would end up in jail, dead, or broke, sitting under a tree. Two of those things absolutely happened for brief moments in my life. Clearly, death wasn't one of them, but that failure to listen led me to jail and sitting under the tree broke. That failure to listen also led me to who I am today because it made me start listening. Smart people learn from their own mistakes. Wise people learn from the mistakes of others. Sometimes we have to bump our own heads in order to learn. Well, that's exactly what I did, and now I'm here. All praises to God. Fight in review. Bobby Works, the server edition. I've had just about every job there is under the sun, and just as I've learned from the people I've worked with over the years, I've learned something important from every single job I've done. The principles I've gathered from my experiences still apply to my life and career today, so I figured I'd share a few of them with you. If waiting tables isn't a fight, I don't know what is. For a couple of years, I was a proud member of the service industry, aka a busboy and then a waiter. In that time, the biggest shock to my system came with how dependent I was on the generosity of others. As a waiter, you can crush it and do a fantastic job and still get nothing. Or you can do a terrible job and a kind stranger will take pity or just show off in front of their date and tip you big. The upshot was that my entire existence, from rent to food to gas, depended on people tipping me. I didn't have car insurance money unless customers hooked it up. That meant being as helpful and as positive as I could in my interactions with everyone, no matter how incredibly rude they could be. And if you've never been a waiter, you have no idea how hateful people can get. I will never forget what it felt like to deal with folks who are ugly and mean for no real reason except for a superiority complex. Perhaps that's the greatest gift I got from waiting tables. The desire to never, ever be an ugly, mean person to someone who's waiting on me. I'd like to take a moment and do a PSA on how to treat wait staff. So bear with me, because here goes. Next time you're in a restaurant, do these things for me. One, don't be an awful person. Two, understand that this waiter has to deal with people being ugly and mean for absolutely no reason all the time. And they have to smile through the experience because they have to buy toothpaste and tampons. Three, your servers are people too. Working hard, they go home to their lives just like you do from your job. Four, servers also control your food, and they control your food when you don't see your food. And they can do whatever they want to your food in the kitchen. So don't be a jerk, because it's not nice, and you may compel them to fart or spit in your food. Number five, tip like your bill payments depend on it, because theirs do. And if something happens at a restaurant that's not right, remember, there could be many reasons. Your server is only the face or front line of the whole operation. In my experience, the kitchen messed up a lot of things I was asked to provide, and I got blamed. And do you know what I had to do? I had to take it. I said I was sorry, and then I tried to fix the problem by adding a little something extra. You're paying for a meal and the service, so it should be pretty right on. But if it's not, don't freak. Once, I dropped an entire tray of drinks, probably 8 drinks, all over a table. One man bore the brunt of almost all the liquid. I was mortified. I ran to get him a towel. I got him lots of towels. He didn't yell. And the table continued their dinner. I felt terrible. At the end of the night, he left me a $100 tip on a bill of $120. There was a note. The note read, "It happens to the best of us. It's not the mistakes we make, but how we handle it afterward. Thanks for hanging in there." That was on the note. I was blown away. The gesture was so kind that I wanted to cry. If I could find that man now, here's what I would say. "Mr. Gentleman in your late 40s from 17 years ago in the gray suit who had a tray of liquid spilled on him in the Hot Springs Village. I appreciate you. I still remember you to this day. The moment we shared many years ago in the DeSoto Club made me a better person." That's what I would say. And you know, I use that situation constantly to remind myself the power of extending grace. Doing good things stand the test of time. There's an example right there. For the record, I'm the greatest tipper known to man, excluding those rich celebrities that will drop $10,000 because they hear that a server's great-grandma needs a new eye, a fact that was obviously randomly mentioned during the meal. You know, I always wonder about those huge tips that celebrities leave. How many times did the waiter have to bring that story up for someone to finally give in and buy that eyeball? And do they just use, "I'm an in-need waiter," for the famous people? You know, the rich-looking people in the nice clothes eating lobster? Do they use it on all the people? My guess would be that they try to shoehorn their sob story in as much as possible, just in case. And every once in a while, as my grandma would say, even a blind squirrel finds a nut. I would be in absolute shock if a one-time mention turned into a $9,000 tip on a $42 dinner bill. But what do I know? By the way, I'm not hating. Nothing illegal is happening. Nobody is getting hurt. And total transparency, when I was working in an older person part of town, I didn't stop the ladies from pinching my butt on occasion. When you're in the fight, you do whatever it takes. Part 2. Grind. Chapter 5. It's as bad as it sounds. Imagine this. You're not a morning person. Not at all. In fact, you're the kind of person who likes to stay up and watch all the late night comedy shows every single night and then sleep late. Then imagine that in order to do your job, and I don't mean do your job well, but just do the bare minimum, like showing up on time, that you have to wake up every weekday morning at 3 a.m. Sounds like a living hell, right? Yep. This has been my life for more than 15 years. I can't tell you how horrible it is to hate mornings so much, yet have to experience them so fully. There is no amount of caffeine that can make the crack of dawn okay for me. There's a range of torture, and it goes from soul-crushing to just plain awful. Every single time my alarm goes off so that I can make it into the studio to wake everybody else up with my radio show, it's a struggle. And by my calculations, I've hit that stupid phone alarm at an ungodly hour about 4,000 times since my career began. This is the grind. The dirty work. If you're listening to this book in order, you're ready for the fight. You figured out a goal or vision for yourself. You've analyzed your motivations, and now you've got the fire in your belly. Maybe your fight is getting your kids to do their homework every night. Maybe your fight is keeping the warehouse you manage running at top level. Whatever it is that you're looking to succeed at doing, from being a good parent to opening a restaurant to doing a radio show, you're going to have to grind. You're going to have to execute all those tiny, everyday, ordinary tasks that put you in position to make the big things happen. Also, let me say beforehand that I'm going to use the word grind a lot in this section. In the context of fight, grind, repeat, I feel as if it represents the grinding of a material. However, it's also the term that I use at times to describe my dancing to songs like Genuine Pony. Yeah, the grind. It will not be used in the dancing context at all this section. So friends, get your mind out of the freak dancing gutter. Each of us makes so many decisions every day that these decisions can come off as insignificant. But I argue that these decisions create the structure for your dreams, sort of like bricks that create a home. I have options now when it comes to my radio morning show. I could go to bed later, sleep in longer, and have one of my producers do the work of gathering the daily content that I do the night before every show, by reading the news, watching television, taking notes, writing bits. I mean, maybe if I got more sleep, I wouldn't hate morning so much. But to be honest, a late night for me is staying awake past 9 p.m. now. I don't have producers creating large amounts of material for my show, even if it would make my life easier, because I don't think the end product would be as authentic or frankly as good. The thing is, I'm probably wrong. I bet my producers would probably crush it. The grind is relentless. As I said in the introduction, it means taking the fight and doing it again, again, and again. Going back to my boxing classes analogy, look at it this way. Anyone can fight for short amounts of time. That's why boxing matches consist of 3-minute rounds. It's 3 short minutes over and over. You might be able to get through 3 minutes of punches, but to keep going back for more, the repetition is the killer. As my football coach back in Mountain Pine, Vic Gandalf, used to say, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. This is a step where a lot of people lose their way. Partly, that's because the grind is not exciting or glamorous, but it's also because it's not straightforward. If the fight is about the idea, then the grind is the actions you need to take, and those are never straightforward. Once you've figured out what's important to you in the big picture, you've got to start filling in all the small details. This is where failure comes in, because really, none of us knows what the heck we're doing here. You have to do a whole lot of trying to figure out what actually works before you land on the right actions, like me and my TV show ideas. I keep throwing them out there, some of which I'm sure are going to be winners. But so far, nothing stuck. I've done this fight, grind, repeat thing long enough to know that I will eventually get it right. The grind is everything that's not going to get you whatever piece of glory that you're looking for, but it gets you closer to maybe having a shot at the piece of glory that you're looking for. Finding your success is like dealing with your health. Everybody's body is different. There are some things that most successful people have in common that make them successful, but there's no one size fits all. A doctor can diagnose you with whatever she thinks is the problem, but she doesn't know for sure. Everybody has a different makeup. Essentially, I'm saying that Viagra didn't work for me like it did the other guys, okay? Fight, grind, repeat is a process. And one of the most important elements I've learned from it is that if you're ever going to stick with something long enough to be in the position to succeed, you have to burrow a tunnel in your mind that ends with your goal. It's not unlike how horses wear blinders so they can only see what's in front of them. There can be no distractions, especially what the other horses are doing as they race to their goal. But unfortunately, our paths aren't as neat as a racetrack. When you start down your tunnel or path, you'll find it forks into smaller paths and often dead ends. Then you have to turn around and seek out bigger, smoother paths. Your lifeboat during the grind is consistency. It's consistently doing the small things and doing them all the time. Developing a pattern is absolute because if you aren't doing the little things right, you definitely won't do the big things right. My grind of waking up early every morning is at once the easiest and hardest thing for me to do. I mean, all I have to do is get my butt out of my warm, soft bed when the alarm goes off. My mattress is very nice. One of those sleep number jobs that predict your movements. Yeah, fancy. But no matter how many years go by of this pattern, every morning, the little evil voice in my head tells me to hit the snooze button. I don't listen, though. After the initial discomfort passes, I know that I'm going to get up, go to the job I love, work as hard as I can that day, pay attention to the little details, and crush it. That's why, literally, I have never hit my snooze button. By the way, I'd like to say something about using the word literally. Please use it only in its accurate sense. I'm fine if you say, my head exploded when my boss handed me this assignment. I get it. You probably had a lot going on mentally. You can even say, my head exploded figuratively when my boss handed me this assignment. Not the route I would take, but it's accurate. But don't say, literally my head exploded, because you're lying. It didn't. We still get what you're saying without you using a word that means you are describing something exactly as it happened. Now listen, I know this has nothing to do with the concept of this book, but do me a solid. Stop saying things are literal when they aren't. Just say it. You lose nothing. Thank you. Tech tools for the grind. I'm a big believer in using your smartphone as a tool in fight, grind, repeat. You're looking at the stupid thing all day anyway, so you might as well put it to better use than checking out your ex-husband's Instagram feed. I use my phone in all sorts of ways. You'll hear more about that in chapter 6. But one app that I found helpful for the grind is Streaks, the to-do list that helps you form good habits. Now, I'm sure there are a billion of this kind of habit tracking app on the market, and I'm not getting paid for this. Although Streaks, if you want to send a check, please make it out to Bobby Estill, or Venmo is fine since we're talking apps. This just happens to be the one app that I use and I like, but feel free to go ahead and find a better one. Streaks works this way. You get to choose up to 12 tasks you want to turn into daily habits. The limited number of habits is purposeful, since it forces you to decide what things are truly important to you and concentrate on those. You come up with them yourself, so they can be anything from drinking 8 glasses of water, to writing in your journal, to wrestling an aardvark. Every time you complete the task, you tap this big button on the screen and boom, you get another day in your streak. If you skip a day, you go back to zero. You can set the app for habits that aren't meant for every day without breaking your streak, like getting to work on time. That can be Monday through Friday. The reason this app works is that, one, it's really simple. Two, there's nothing more satisfying than hitting that big old button. And three, there's nothing worse than breaking your streak once you get going. The Streaks creator told a website called raywinderlich.com, which is a site for programmers, the core idea behind his app, quote, "To become successful is really just a matter of persistence. You keep trying things. Many will fail. Eventually, some things succeed. These things won't last forever either. Then it's on to the next thing." Sounds like a grinder to me. Not to be confused with the Tasty Sandwich or with Grindr, another app. Equally effective, but for totally different purposes. Sweat the small stuff. Oh, I'm best under pressure. Wait until I get the big stage, then I'll really turn it on. Or, when I'm the boss, I'm going to show them how it's done. Have you ever heard anyone express those sentiments? Ever said something like that yourself? Thinking like this keeps you stuck. If you don't perfect the small things, you won't even have a shot at doing the big stuff where it counts. And if for some crazy reason you do get a lucky break, like your uncle owns the company, or the song you wrote and performed yourself goes viral, if you haven't perfected the art of yourself, you're going to flame out faster than Chumbawamba. By the way, if you don't remember Chumbawamba, YouTube it real quick. They had that song, Tub Thumping. It's one of the biggest one-hit wonders I've ever experienced. You know, I get knocked down, but I get up again. Remember that one? Yeah, it was the jam back in the day for sure. But what happened to them? I hope they all didn't die. I just Googled it. They didn't die, literally. But figuratively, they are dead. Sing it with me. Pissing the night away. They don't make songs like that anymore, kids. When I look for people to hire, promote, or partner with, it's fantastic if they have big accomplishments. But some folks have impressive achievements because of factors that don't show up on their resume. That's why I look at the small details, which I found to be a much better indicator of future successes than fancy titles. I'll get more into the nitty-gritty of this in Chapter 7, but what I'm talking about is common sense stuff. Things like, does this person show up to work late? Does he send out mass emails with tons of typos? Does she regularly hand in assignments late? These are the small factors that don't seem to mean much in the moment, but add up quickly to become a real problem. The details just don't matter in professional settings. In fact, they probably mean even more in personal ones. Sending handwritten thank you cards. Checking in with someone who hasn't shown up to exercise class in a while, even though she isn't a great friend. Just telling a kid when he did a good job. These are the small acts that often have a lot more impact than grand gestures. I like to watch how people treat others when it doesn't matter or they don't think anyone else is looking. Picking up litter at a gas station, so somebody who works there doesn't have to. Or not getting angry at the waiter when he delivers the wrong meal. They can be real insights into character. It's returning the shopping cart to the store after you've put all your groceries into the car. I know what you're thinking. There are people starving all over this planet, and you're worried about grocery carts. Yes, you can look at it as not having any effect in the grand scheme of things, or just the opposite. If everyone did one small act of kindness every day, the effect would be huge. That's the shopping cart conundrum. I'm going to roll this grocery cart and put it back so the person working here has one less cart to fetch in the parking lot versus, I have my groceries in the trunk. Time to get home as fast as I can, unload them, and turn on This Is Us and eat ice cream. I mean, sure, we're all worried that our ice cream is going to melt, but the folks who resist that instinct because they understand the consequences beyond their own personal reality prove there's more than one layer to their thought process, and they think of people outside themselves. I've given this shopping cart idea a lot of thought. I freaking worked at Hobby Lobby and had to gather all the carts. I know the shopping cart struggle on a personal level. I guarantee that people who care about the little things will definitely get it right when it comes to the big things. The grind is every day. Small details, consistency, tunnel vision, establishing good habits, discipline, determination. The grind to end all grinds. For a lot of folks, myself included, eating right is the ultimate grind. The fight is losing weight or just being healthy. But the grind is the regimen of not shoving donuts, pizza, and Cap'n Crunch chicken tenders into your face every day. The classic scenario goes something